if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
When I first walked on that beach, there were hundreds of dogs running in packs. It was completely overwhelming. You just had no idea where to start or who to rescue. It was just unbelievable.
Chrissy Beckles has literally been the difference between life and death for the abused and abandoned stray dogs of Puerto Rico, called Satos. In 2011, Chrissy founded her nonprofit, The Sato Project. Since then, she and her team have rescued more than 1,000 stray dogs from a beach in southeastern Puerto Rico that is actually called Playa Lucia, but to which locals refer as Dead Dog Beach due to the number of animals dumped there. The Sato Project captures and rehabilitates the stray dogs, giving them food and veterinary care. Then, when the dogs are well, they fly them off the island to new forever or foster homes. As of November 2016, the Sato Project is celebrating 5 years of animal rescue. But while Chrissy and her team have made a dramatic difference on Dead Dog Beach, their future goals reach far beyond Playa Lucia.
Chrissy, what do you remember very best about growing up in England that instilled in you the compassion for animals that you have?
Growing up in England, we always had dogs, and I'm the only girl in my extended family. I have brothers, and kind of it was all their friends and my cousins, so I was the only girl and was a real tomboy, but we used to, my father, who sadly passed away, was a school teacher, so we would get long vacations. And we would spend them in North Wales in a wonderful place called Abbotsock. And I, at 2 years old, was put on a horse and thought it was the greatest thing ever. So I grew up with horses and dogs, and I really wanted to be a vet. We used to stay on a farm every summer, and it was owned by a wonderful veterinary. And I watched him, you know, birth calves and sheep and wasn't put off by any of it, but I was just dreadful at, you know, biology in school. I was awful. So unfortunately, that kind of dream had to be put to the wayside, and I never had any idea that this would become kind of my passion and take over my life. When I look back, it's kind of funny that it was probably meant to be, but I had a career in advertising. I was a media buyer and worked in an ad agency. And so the two worlds were kind of very far apart. And I gave all that up to rescue doggies. So I think it was instilled in me from a very young age, the love of animals. I never had dolls as a kid. I always wanted like the little furry toys. And that was my thing. I wanted, you know, the otter and the bear and, you know, dogs and things. No dolls. Always animals.
How did you first become aware of Dead Dog Beach in Puerto Rico?
It's all my husband's fault. My wonderful husband, Bobby, is a stuntman. And 10 years ago, he had come to Puerto Rico to film down here. He was here for a couple of months, and he was working on this movie, Che, with Benicio del Toro. And I was coming to spend a week with him, and we had one dog at the time. And before I came down here, he said to me, "Chrissy, you're going to freak out when you see the dogs down here." And I was like, "That doesn't sound very good." So I got here in Puerto Rico, spent a week with him, and wasn't on Dead Dog Beach, was in other areas. And I spent a week feeding dogs, taking them to the vet, and just generally feeling completely overwhelmed. You know, having no idea what I could do aside from giving them food, giving them water, and trying to get them some kind of medical care. At the time, I had my own consulting business. I had a very nice job consulting for Estee Lauder companies. But at the end of the week, I got on my plane, and I always joke it was my Oprah moment, because I plotted for 3 hours on my American Airlines flight how I was going to do something about what I'd seen, because I just couldn't leave and forget about it. So I went back to New York and I did some research, and I found two groups. They were the only two that responded to me. I kind of hounded them and said, you know, I've been to the island, how can I help? And it's funny, kind of 10 years on now, I get those emails all the time, and I write back to people and say, well, this is how you can help us. And they did pretty much the same. Said, you know, we always need donations. We need people that can foster, that can transport, and like, sign me up. I can do whatever. So I spent 2.5, 3 years volunteering for them. And I always say that it was my Harvard education in rescue, because I learned so much from these two tremendous women, Elizabeth Kratz and Ginny Cornett, that ran two separate rescue groups. And they were incredibly generous with their time and really helped me get an understanding of what was going on the island. And Bobby would be down here filming, because Puerto Rico has a lot of tax breaks, so there's a lot of, you know, TV and movie work goes on down here. So every time he filmed, I would come down, I would work with them, I would donate like a stupid amount of money, and I would transport. And almost 3 years into it, Bobby was working with Johnny Depp on The Rum Diaries, and I was spending some time with him in Puerto Rico. And the crew found out about what I was doing. And between Johnny and the crew, they raised money, and I was able to rescue 16 dogs in a week. And at the end of that week, I sat at the bar with my husband, and we always joke that he's a cheap date, because you give him like one cocktail and he's anybody's. So I bought him a very strong drink, and I said to him, I want to quit my job. This is my calling. I really want to rescue full time. And I thought he was going to say, what are you, nuts? But I guess the strong drink worked. And he said, okay. And I said, no, I'm really going to do it. I'm going to go back to New York, and I'm going to quit my job. We have a saying in the Beckles family. You probably have to bleep this bit, but it's like, if you're going to do something, just don't f*** it up. And so he's like, you can do it. I will give you some money. Just don't f*** it up. And I was like, I won't. So I went back to New York, and I quit my job, and I started rescuing full-time. And in 2011, I started the Sato Project. At that point, I've had an introduction to Dead Dog Beach. When I first walked on that beach, there were hundreds of dogs running in packs. It was completely overwhelming. You just had no idea where to start or who to rescue, or it was just unbelievable to see. The dynamic was so, so different to how it is now. And, you know, I'm working with groups that, or I was volunteering for groups that didn't have a lot of money. I mean, that's the thing in rescue. There's always the commitment, but there's never the funding to kind of back it up. So you would have to, one of the most heartbreaking things was to stand in front of a group of dogs and know you would only have the money to take one. And essentially, by taking that one, you were maybe giving the others a death sentence, because you could go back the next day and, you know, they might have been run over, or they've died from kind of medical issues, or sadly on that beach, there's a lot of abuse and torture goes on. So you would take one and it would just break your heart with the others. And that's always been ingrained in me. And my wish was always that I wouldn't have to do that, that I would be able to be on that beach and take whomever showed up, whichever dogs were there, I'd be able to take them in. And that's always, it's been a huge fuel, and it's kind of one of our mottos as an organization, that we will always go back for the next one. I kind of joke that that's what American Express is for. My Amex card should be on fire at this point.
I'm imagining it smoking.
Yeah, absolutely. It has its own fire extinguisher. I'm the person that I'm like, I will take you and I will figure out how to pay for it afterwards. Probably not that my CPA hates me, but we always figure a way. So that's how it started. So my husband is still my biggest advocate, my biggest supporter, my partner in this. He is unbelievable, but I always joke. I'm like, this is all your fault. We laugh about it.
Let's look at some of the reasons behind the plight of the dogs that you found. How are the dogs seen differently than they are in North America?
It's very much a cultural thing that dogs are treated differently here in Puerto Rico than we, for instance, in New York or in the majority of the United States, see dogs. We see them as family members, and they live in our homes, and You know, they get regular veterinary care, they're spayed or neutered, they're up to date on vaccines. Down here on the island, the culture is really not to spay or neuter. So that in turn, combined with the fact that a lot of these dogs, quote unquote, belong to people, run kind of free in the streets, and they're not spayed and neutered, is a recipe for disaster. So you've got, you know, dogs procreating, and then, you know, all of a sudden somebody's dog had puppies and nobody knows what to do with them, and so that dog gets thrown out on the street, and then you've got puppies that aren't spayed and neutered, and it just becomes a vicious cycle. Or people don't know what to do with these puppies, so they're dumping them on the beach that we work on. I mean, just to give you an idea how this island works, it's roughly the size of the state of Connecticut, and there are 78 municipalities in Puerto Rico. By law, every municipality is supposed to have some kind of animal control or facility in place. So remember that number 78. There are 4 animal shelters on this island. And because of that, they are completely overwhelmed and they have a 99% euthanasia rate. Basically, a dog doesn't even get 24 hours when they go to a shelter. They're essentially getting walked straight back to be euthanized. And there's not a culture of adoption here, unfortunately. So there are a group of people that are overwhelmed. You know, their dogs aren't spayed or neutered. They have puppies and they don't know what to do with them. They understand if they take them to the shelter, the dogs are going to be killed. So they feel like, I'm going to take them to this beach, or I'm just going to let them run in the street and I'm going to hope that they'll be okay. It's a behavior that I don't necessarily condone, but I understand it. You know, if you're faced with the two decisions, what are you going to do? You're going to try and give the dog the best chance that they can have. But, you know, that endless cycle of reproduction, and then combined with dogs not seeing licensed veterinarians, so then, unfortunately, you know, disease becomes rampant. I mean, I come from the United Kingdom. We have not had a case of rabies in the United Kingdom for, I couldn't even tell you how many years. I think maybe 1930s, maybe earlier, because we have very strict, you know, vaccine laws, and we're an island. And this is a much smaller concentration here. But unbelievably to me, there is no mandatory vaccine, certainly not for rabies, law in place here. There's no reason why that kind of disease could not be eradicated here. But unfortunately, the governor of this island does not see the stray population as something that needs to be addressed. And it should be. I mean, tourism is one of the, if not the, you know, the biggest industry here. And I, for one, have lost count of the amount of emails and phone calls and social media messages that I've had from people that have come here that never want to return, because when they get here and they see how animals are treated, they're horrified. And so, you know, the governor really needs to address that, and sadly doesn't. And I've met with 3 different administrations, and at this point, I'm not wasting my time anymore, because I get yes to death in, you know, the beautiful Fortaleza home in San Juan, and then I walk out of the door and nothing ever gets done. So I prefer to do things my way. We get no funding from the government here. We're a 501c3. Every penny that we spend on this island has been raised by us. We're not getting any help from here. We have some incredible volunteers that are unbelievably dedicated. And, you know, there are people here that are so frustrated with what is going on, and they're really trying. But this is an island with 25% unemployment now, and I'm sure everybody's reading about the economic issues that Puerto Rico is facing. And very sadly, if, you know, you're living below the poverty line, which a lot of people on this island are, and you have animals, then they're the first ones that are really going to suffer. It's a really, really, really sad fact. I mean, the municipality where Dead Dog Beach is a place called Yabucoa. It's the poorest municipality in Puerto Rico. It has a population of around 35,000 people, and 50, over 50% of them are living below the federal poverty line. You're looking at an average household of four people that has an income of below $17,000. So when you kind of look at those statistics, you get a better understanding of what's happening here. So because of that, as an organization, we've existed now, we're going into our fifth year, and we would, you know, we go to Dead Dog Beach every day. We have incredible volunteers that go every morning, every afternoon. They care for the dogs. They give fresh food, fresh water. There's no food or water source on that beach. So if we didn't go, these dogs would starve. And as funds and space allow, we bring them into our program. Now, I understand that I'm putting a Band-Aid on an open, gaping, horrible wound. So this year, as an organization, we've taken our work a step further, and we're starting to do low-cost spay-neuter in the Yabucoa community, spay-neuter vaccine and microchip. And for $35, people can come, they can get their dog completely vaccinated, microchipped, spayed or neutered. It's over $130 worth of services, and as an organization, we underwrite, you know, the balance of the cost. And between various programs that we have working, one is a mobile clinic that we run in conjunction with Humane Society International and a wonderful vet, Dr. Cruz, who has a mobile clinic. We do a clinic once a month in Yabucoa, and we treat between 30 and 36 dogs in a day at that clinic. Then we have a voucher program where between 30 and 40 dogs a month get treated at our veterinary office. And then we're looking to do help the stray population as well with this program. So we have our rescue arm, and then in addition to that, with the spay-neuter initiatives, we're going to treat an additional 900 dogs this year, which gives me sleepless nights because we have to raise the money to do it. But it's the only way that we're going to make a lasting impact, and we know there's a need for it. The first mobile clinic that we advertised, we had 150 people trying to sign up for 30 spots. So we know that there's a need for that on the island, and it's really, really important.
I would love for you to tell me a little bit more about your rescue program, but I'd love to know first how people can help and support you in the Sato Project.
Donations are so unbelievably welcomed. It doesn't matter whether it's $1 or $10,000 or $100,000. We pride ourselves on having a program where I think 93% of all of our funds went directly to program operations last year. That means like 93 cents out of every dollar that somebody donates to us is going directly to, you know, either vet, transport, or help us rescue these dogs. This is the first year in 10 that I've actually got a salary for what I do, and I work on average a 16-hour day, and I've not had a day off in 5 years. This is overtaken my life, and I love it dearly, but I've made huge sacrifices to do what I do. We have a tiny but incredibly dedicated team, so we really rely on donations, and people can donate them because we're a 501c3 organization. You know, your donations are tax deductible, and you can do so on our website, which is www.thesatoproject.org.
TheSatoProject.org.
Yes.
People find a lot of different ways they can donate as well, some that might not have occurred to them.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, I understand that people can't always donate money. They could donate time. We have a wonderful foster program. We transport all of our dogs into New York, so we need help when the dogs get to the airport to get them to either foster homes, forever homes, or to one of our wonderful shelter partners. You know, people that have social media experience or graphic design experience or could help with administration tasks, there's always something that somebody can do. It's, you know, if you can't adopt, you could foster. If you can't foster, you could maybe transport. If you can't transport, then you could certainly tell a friend or share our work. There's always something that somebody can do, even if it's just a case of telling your neighbor or a colleague or a family member, hey, have you heard about this organization? This is what they're doing. They're doing amazing work. Do you think maybe you could help them? Because you never know who's listening. And we've had some really wonderful things happen, you know, very kind of organically like that. So please don't ever think that there's not anything you can do. That's the biggest lesson I've learned out of this. When I got on that plane 10 years ago thinking, what can I do? This is completely overwhelming. I could have had a cocktail and gone back to New York and carried on my career, but I was like, no, I have to do something. I didn't know what it was going to be that I would do, but I figured it out. And, you know, even if you think it's a teeny tiny thing that's not going to make a difference, it is. Because every dog that we take off that beach and we bring into our program, it's making a difference to them. So that's how you have to think about it.
Let's choose one of the dogs that you have rescued, and I'd like to have you tell me his or her story and illustrate what happens from the moment you get to Dead Dog Beach to the time that dog gets to New York. What do you do, and how does this work?
I've got a couple of real standouts. God, I hope I don't stop falling on the phone now. We had a dog, Victor Amour, that we rescued on Mother's Day, which was a Sunday in 2012 or 13. This little dog was so weak and so malnourished he couldn't even walk. So I knew from that fact that somebody had driven him to this beach and left him there. It was raining. Yvette, our wonderful beach volunteer, had gone to feed the dogs at the beach and do her rounds. And I got a phone call from her saying, Chrissy, I found this dog. He's in awful condition. You know, I think he needs to be humanely euthanized because he's just beyond. So our vet's office is closed on a Sunday. There's only two kind of 24-hour clinics on the island. So Yvette and I drove the dog to the San Juan area and went to the 24-hour emergency clinic. And this poor little thing, he had like three hairs on him. You could feel every bone in his body. And he was just shutting down. And the vet that was on call that day was a vet called Dr. Victor Alisea. And he looked at me and he shook his head as if to say, there's nothing we can do for this dog. And to this day, I still don't know what made me do it, because we consider ourselves a no-kill organization, but I'm not going to allow a dog to suffer. But I looked at this dog, and I'm an amateur boxer, so I use, and I still compete, and I fight now to raise money for our organization. I looked at him, and I picked up his head. He couldn't even hold up his head, and I said to him, if you will fight, I will fight for you. And there was just something in his eyes that I saw, and I said to this doctor, we're going to do whatever it takes. So we put him on a heat pad. This dog had blood transfusions, and he made it. I don't know how he did, but this dog made it. And he turned around, and we posted his story on social media, and he had thousands upon thousands of people, like, cheering him on. And I think this dog knew. Somehow he knew. And he went from being this, you know, little bag of bones to a dog that helped me train for a fight and walked me into the ring in the July following. And I was so, you know, I was bawling as I was walking to the ring with this dog. We named him Victor Amour. We named him Victor after the vet that saved him. And Amour was love. It means love. So he was one, and he got adopted by a wonderful family on Long Island that also have another one of my rescues. And he has a fantastic life. He's magnificent. And then the other one that really sticks out in my mind is a dog named Adrian, who we rescued in August of 2014. It was about 7 o'clock at night, and I got a phone call from a vet saying that she'd found a dog that had been hit by a car and drowned. And this dog had three horrifically injured legs. And she sent me a photograph, and the photograph was horrific. So I called my vet, Dr. Bianca Aguirre Hernandez, and she agreed to go to the vet clinic after hours to humanely euthanize this dog, because she was, and this was a 50-pound dog, a big dog, that had three bad legs. So we took her to the clinic. I mean, when we rescued her, this was kind of how panicked it was. We didn't even look whether she was a boy or a girl. We thought she was a boy. And I, using the whole fight analogy, said, we're going to call, this is Rocky. This dog has to be a fighter. Didn't even look whether it was a boy or a girl. And then Bianca kind of called me a couple of hours later and said, you do realize this dog's a girl, right? And I was like, oh my goodness. So Rocky's wife is Adrian, so she became Adrian. And She cleaned out her wounds and put her on pain meds and said, if she survives the night, it'll be a miracle. She's not in any pain right now. I don't think she'll be with us in the morning. Well, this dog survived the night. And the next morning, Bianca looked at her wounds again and said her two front legs were very badly broken and she had her back right leg was dislocated. And she said, like, the bones are so shredded, I really don't think there's any way that they can be treated. And you have to make a call, Chrissy. And sadly, as the president of this organization, I'm the one that has to make that really crappy decision of euthanasia. And it's not a decision I ever make lightly. I always defer to the experts. And the expert in this case, my vet, was telling me that I needed to say yes. So I said, okay. I was devastated, but I said, okay, yep, let's humanely euthanize her. So Bianca went to pick up Adrian to take her to the surgery room, and Adrian wagged her tail. So I got a call from Bianca in tears saying to me, she's wagging her tail. And that was our sign. I said, you know what? If she's wagging her tail, there's something there. We're going to give this a go. I have no idea what we're going to do, but we're going to give it a go. This dog had 5 major surgeries. We actually flew her to New York for specialist surgery. She cost me $20,000, but she survived. And again, she walked me into the ring last year when I fought in July. And this dog now runs like the wind. She's incredible. And, you know, people say to me, well, $20,000 on one dog, that's insane. But you know what? To this dog, and it's the woman that adopted her. Her name is now Sugar. She kind of kept it in the boxing genre. This dog's worth $1 million, and she is. Her tail never stopped wagging through having a plate in her leg to having the plate taken out because it got infected, to going through major physical therapy. I mean, this dog went to hell and back and never, ever stopped smiling or being happy. So those are the ones. We have another saying as an organization that we fight for these dogs, and we do. And I understand that other people might have said, we don't have the money. I certainly didn't have $20,000 sat around for this dog, but I was like, screw it, I'll find it somewhere. I will, if I have to get in a ring and fight to raise the money, I'll do it. And people really got behind her, and we had wonderful surgeons that operated on her at cost because they just fell in love with her, and she's a huge success story. And those are the ones when you have bad days that you always remember, and that's why you say, because of Victor Amor and because of Adrian. And we brought a dog in a couple of weeks ago called Francesco that's in hideous, hideous condition. You look at them and, you know, they break your heart every time, but they also give you a renewed sense when you see just how incredibly resilient these dogs are. And that's, you know, I often get asked, like, why Puerto Rico? What's so special about these dogs? I have never, ever met dogs like this. They have the capacity to survive and to get through things and to not bear grudges. And they're so, they really are. It sounds so unbelievably corny, but they inspire me every day. Adrian had every reason to be snippy and bite at people and just be a horror. Because if I'd gone through what she did, I would be like, screw you, world, don't come near me. And her tail never stopped wagging. She never met anybody she didn't like. She didn't want to kiss, be on their knee. And the same with Victor Amor and all of these dogs. They have been shot and they have had limbs hacked off and eyes taken out. And they have this unbelievable capacity to forgive and continue and go forth and just keep moving forward. It's so incredible to watch and witness, and I feel it's unbelievable to be able to see it and to be part of it, and I feel very, very blessed that I do get to see that, and it really does. When I see that, it makes me want to go back to the next one and do it again, no matter. You know, not every story has a happy ending. It doesn't. I've held way too many dogs while they've had to be put to sleep or they've died in my arms. And it's horrific. But those that make it are the ones that give you, I always call it my fuel, to go back for the next one and the one after that.
Now that I've got goose pimples, because what a story. Wow.
Yeah.
What is the average cost? Sugar is a great investment, I would have to agree. $20,000 does not sound like too much for what happened for sugar. But what's the average cost, let's say, of finding a dog on Dead Dog Beach and bringing him or her back to New York? Can we even lay an average on this?
Oh, yeah, I have an average. We average, before we put a dog on a plane, about $1,000. As an organization, we have an incredibly strict vetting protocol. And this was something, when I talk about a Harvard education in rescue from volunteering with other groups, you know, I learned what they were doing, where they spent money, where they couldn't spend money. And when I started the organization, I sat down with my vet and said, okay, let's approach this differently. If we're going to start a rescue group, we want to do this in the best way possible. If money were no object, how would we vet these dogs so they would be completely healthy and have no infectious or contagious disease? They essentially can walk straight into a home and be fine. And so we started to write a protocol. And it meant that the first year of operations, we only set ourselves a goal of 52 dogs, because we said one dog a week that we vet to this standard, and that will be our goal. And it's an ever-evolving protocol. It's up to about 12 pages now. But the first test as an organization that we do when we test every dog is a PCR test for distemper. It's a blood test. And it cost me $150. So we've rescued 1,500 dogs, so just do the math on that. That's the very first test we do. And then, you know, there's vaccines and there's blood work and, you know, a lot of these doggies have heartworm, which is a disease that is carried by a mosquito. There's leptospirosis, anaplasmosis, and ehrlichia, which are also mosquito or tick-borne diseases, which are prevalent down here because we're in a tropical climate. Very sadly, parvovirus and distemper are huge issues down here, hence why every dog that comes in gets a test for distemper. My biggest fear is to ever put a dog on a plane that was sick. And with good conscience, I've never done it because I know what our protocols are.
The 1,500 dogs the Sato Project has rescued so far have gone to new homes in a number of different locations.
The majority of our dogs go into New York, but we have sent dogs to Las Vegas, to Hollywood, to Florida, to Texas, to Chicago, New Orleans. We've had a dog go to Vancouver. We even had a dog that flew on a private jet to Bermuda.
Let's guess that will be a very pampered dog and will deserve it very richly.
Oh, I know. I kind of joke that this was a beautiful dog. He was like a big kind of retriever mix. And we named him Goliath. And we always called him like the king of Dead Dog Beach because he had this pack of dogs that would follow him around. So when we rescued him, we brought in the whole pack because we couldn't take the leader and not bring in all the others. And so we joked that he went from being like the king of Dead Dog Beach to like the king of Bermuda. And I kind of had this little scenario in my head that, like, Goliath, you know, remember me as he was stepping onto his G5 to make his flight to Bermuda, you know. Remember the girl that saved you? Care to take me with you? And he was like, oh, I'm too good for you now.
I am royalty. I am going to Bermuda. I can just see it.
Exactly. Yeah. King of the beach to king of an island.
What are the changes that you've seen since you started working with the Sato Project in Dead Dog Beach? And what changes would you most like to see in the future?
There's been a lot. You know, if there weren't, I was either doing something wrong or might have given up, you know, a long time ago. But I'm like this scrappy little Brit who refuses to take no for an answer. And if a door slams in my face, I'm the one that punches or kicks it down. We have now started to work with the mayor of Yabucoa, which is the municipality where Dead Dog Beach is. And the relationship was a little rocky in the beginning, but we've had some fantastic media coverage as an organization, and CNN followed us last year. and they put out a 5-minute video that went viral that was broadcast on CNN US, and then they translated it into Spanish, and it was doing so well that they broadcast it on international as well. And I put this video in front of the mayor of Yabucoa, and I'd been talking to him for years, and I felt like nothing that I ever said to him actually impacted, or he really kind of took in. But when he saw a major news network had come and put together this 5-minute vignette and followed us for a couple of days, we'd rescued a pregnant basset hound off the beach and been with us kind of every step of the way. Once it was put in front of him in that kind of genre, he couldn't deny it anymore, and he was horrified. And I have a photograph that I took of his face when he was sat with his entire cabinet, and he just looked mortified. And he said to me after it finished, "What can I do to help you?" And I've got the list that I've been writing for 10 years. So I was like, here's something I prepared earlier. This is what I need from you. And so he became at that point, that was a real turning point in our relationship. And now we're working together on this community Beinuta program. One of the things that I'd asked for right at the beginning of working on Dead Dog Beach, there's two entrances to that beach. It's a very remote location, and there's no reason why anybody should be driving to that kind of place at 11, 12, 1 a.m. in the morning. There's no reason. You're only going there for bad reasons, to do illegal things or to dump or to hurt dogs that are there. So I asked, well, can we get a gate up to restrict access? And I thought the chief of police was going to jump up and hug me, because he was like, yes, because if we do that, then, people can't go there to do, break the law in other ways. So in October of 2015, we had a gate put up on one side of the beach that restricts access. And we have definitively seen, a lower number of dogs dumped there now because people just cannot drive there. And I've been asked the question, that's one of my doggies telling the neighborhood that he's here. I do get asked that, do I feel people are dumping dogs elsewhere? I think that possibly is a reality, but if it stops one person, if one person drives up to that gate with a dog in their car and it makes them think or turn around, then that gate has done its job. So there's that aspect. There are signs in place on that beach now that state, the SATO project is caring for the dogs there, that animal abandonment and abuse is against the law in Puerto Rico. I mean, this is the really sad fact. Puerto Rico has some of the strongest animal abuse laws in the whole of the United States. Just the sad fact is they're never enforced. So, we're reminding people that it is against Puerto Rican Law 154 to abandon your dog or to abuse a dog. So those things are in place. And if you walk onto that beach today, you won't see any dogs. Right now, there are 4 feral dogs that we're caring for that sadly will not get within 300-400 yards of us. So they are not candidates at this time to come into our program. But they get food and fresh water every day. And they come out to receive it, and then they go back into their hiding place. And so if somebody, it's funny, I get messages on social media from people that are like, I'm on that beach and I don't see any dogs. Where are all the dogs? And I always say, well, that's a wonderful thing. That means what we're doing is working. It's always a great day when I'm not getting a text at 7 a.m. or at 3 p.m. in the afternoon when Yvette and Juan, our other beach volunteer, are going there, or I go to the beach and I don't see any dogs. That's a fantastic day. It really is. That's the day where it's like, yay, we know what we're doing is working. And when members of the community are saying, wow, we can come to this beach now and exercise because we're not scared of all the dogs running around. And, I'm an animal lover, so to see a pack of dogs is not a bad thing to me. But to other people, it can be scary and intimidating. And I think that's how it used to be there. So I know what we're doing is working. And as an organization, we've always concentrated on that beach. And we made a decision to do so. Because it is a small island, but if we tried to go all over the place and bring in dogs and And I get emails and phone calls and social media messages all day, maybe 20 to 30 a day sometimes, of people asking me to help them. And it breaks my heart that I can't help everybody that needs help. But, you know and we can see like a tangible and visible impact that we have had by concentrating our efforts in this municipality. And what we want to do in conjunction with the mayor is make Yabucoa the first dog-friendly municipality in Puerto Rico. And we're going to do it. We are.
Wow, that is so exciting. Before we have to wrap up, and thank you for your time, you've already told me that you had to get involved, you had to do something. What else would you most like people to get from you about innovation, creativity, and making a difference?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned from this is don't think that you can't make an impact. Don't think that you can't do something, that something is overwhelming. You can make a difference. You can do, you know, it might seem like a teeny tiny thing to you, but to the creature that you're saving or to the child that you're helping or the senior citizen that you're spending time with, it makes a difference. So don't ever think that the one tiny thing that you can do will not make an impact. It will. And who knows, it could lead to bigger and better and greater things and taking over your life like this did with me. When I set out to do this, I really had no idea the journey it would take me on. I have met some incredible people. I have had the best experiences of my life. I don't cry as much as I used to because I'm president of this organization now, and if I cry, it doesn't help anybody. I cry a lot in my shower now and when I go in the boxing gym, and these big tough boxers in Gleason's gym in Brooklyn have kind of got used to me. If I'm on a treadmill or hitting the bag and I'm bawling, and they just pat me on the head or pat me on the back and say, you know, it's all right, Chrissy. They know, you know, we've either lost the dog or we're getting frustrated trying to bring one in. But you can do something. Don't walk away. Don't see something and think that you can't make an impact. You can. I think that's the greatest thing that I've taken away from this. And if you are doing something, you've got to shout it from the rooftops. And like I say, if a door closes, don't walk away from that door. Punch or kick it down. Really, you have to do that. So many people told me no. And like I said, I sat with three different governors of this island that yes me to death and then did nothing. And I was like, well, I know you're not going to help me, so I'm going to go out and do this myself. And we're making a difference. There's 1,500 dogs in incredible homes that otherwise would have died horrific deaths. And so that, it doesn't make me sleep better at night because there are 300,000 stray dogs on this island, and it kind of kills me that I'm never going to be able to help them all, but I can make a difference for some of those dogs. And so that's my fuel to keep going. I think the biggest thing is don't ever think you can't do something. You can.
Chrissy, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be a part of this. I'm really excited. And like I say, I could talk a glass eye to sleep as far as doggies are concerned. So I truly appreciate you contacting me and giving me this opportunity. Thank you, Doc.
You and I have been listening to Chrissy Beckles, founder and president of the nonprofit Sato Project. And congratulations to Chrissy on the Sato Project's 5th anniversary. Check out their website at thesatoproject.org for more information on their current work or to donate or volunteer. As Chrissy mentioned, donations don't necessarily have to be financial. They also need people who can donate their time and skills. That's the Sato Project, spelling Sato, S-A-T-O, thesatoproject.org. Also, if you happen to be in the New York area, the Sato Project would like to invite you to their inaugural fundraiser, Thursday evening, November 10th. They're celebrating their 5th anniversary with their first annual Sato Soiree. There'll be music, dancing, and a great time for a great cause. You'll find more information on their website. Once again, that's thesatoproject.org. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's TWOMAVERIX.com.
And you can contact us at twomavericks@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.